Hello and welcome back to the Extra Movie Butter Podcast, where your favorite three amigos, Benny Hamlin, JTE, myself, Mark the Moose Haas, break down your movie news, your box office, and our new releases. This week, running into theaters is Ethan Hunt himself in the new Mission Impossible installation, Mission Impossible Dead Reckoning Part 1. Of course, I believe that the studio was thinking that this movie was going to be well over $100 million opening, but fell short. So we're going to go straight into the box office, gentlemen. And Mission Impossible led the box office. And now, as we're recording this, we're a little late, but I'm going to review what they did over the weekend. So at the moment, it's at $80 million domestically. Over the weekend, it put up $54 million domestically. However, internationally, it put up gangbusters, which is, I feel like, where these Mission Impossible movies make their bread, and that's $235 million so far internationally. The QAnon classic Sound of Freedom marched into the number two spot with $27 million. This movie's made $85 million domestically so far, knocking out the previous first week winner, which was Insidious the Red Door. They got knocked to third place, $13 million, $58 domestically on a $16 million budget. They'll consider that a win over at, I can't even remember the name Blumhouse. Of the studio. Thank you. There he is. That's what we hired JT here for. He's our fact checker. Coming in fourth, Indiana Jones and the Dial of Destiny, $12 million, $145 million domestic, still a long way to go to make some money there. Elemental coming in at number five, still going strong, $9 million coming in number five, $125 million domestic. Spider-Man Across the Spider-Verse was number six, $6 million. Transformers Rise of the Beast, which is on streaming services now, still in theaters making money, $3 million, $152 million domestic, $900 million internationally for Transformers Rise of the Beast. And then wrapping out your top 10, no hard feelings, Joyride at number nine, and The Little Mermaid still in the top 10, $2 million, $293 million domestic, $700 million internationally. So, gentlemen, I threw a lot of numbers at you guys, but there's always a tale, as we've learned from the box office totals. So, JT, what does the tale tell you?
Yeah, Tom Cruise is still a moneymaker. I think some people were thinking maybe we'll get some Top Gun type numbers. That just felt like a perfect movie for a perfect time to a sequel that is much beloved. It's not like we haven't had our taste of Mission Impossible movies in the past like 20 years. They're always there. And I think when something is always just there, you don't appreciate it as much. Because I do think Mission Impossible has maybe the best action franchise. It's up there for all time. I think that's an argument. I think these movies have gotten better and better and better to varying degrees, which we'll get into some rankings later. But I think there's an asterisk as far as how successful this movie is because it was made during the COVID times. So the production budget was raised way higher than it should have been. And things like that make, I think, to me, it is a success. It is going to make not as much money probably as Fallout. But I do think the quality of the film, along with the amount that it's making, listen, they're not going to cancel part two. So it's coming. I think that is going to be more of a success than this film will be because it's not going to have all that baggage hanging off it. And it wasn't made during COVID, which this film was made during the COVID. And I will argue in our review that that might have affected the film in some ways. But we'll get into that a little bit later. Everything else, I mean, the surprising one is the Jim Caviezel movie. But there's so much drama around that movie and like how much money it's making and who's buying those tickets. I'm not even going to get into that because it just doesn't interest me. I think it's ridiculous. I might watch it one day on Tubi when I'm like bored and have nothing else to watch. But I'm not going out of my way to watch that movie anytime soon. Although, this has nothing to do with box office. I just rewatched a Jim Caviezel movie called Outlander where he plays a space like soldier who lands in Viking times. And it's a mix of like Vikings and sci-fi with like an alien who they think is a dragon. If that sounds cool to you, check out the movie Outlander because I guarantee you it's probably better than whatever this weird movie he has out called. What's it called? What's that weird movie called? Is it something children? What is it, Moose? What is that weird Jim Caviezel movie called? The one that's out right now making
Sound of Freedom.
Sound of Freedom. What a weird title. Sound of Freedom. What is that? Come on.
Well, how about you, Benny? What is the tale of the box office tell you, sir?
I think there'll be a slight asterisk on its opening weekend because it opened on, I think, on like a Tuesday. So its opening weekend is probably higher than the, you know, if you take that into account. But I think it's going to run into some problems next week because of the movies that are opening up against it. So I think if you look back at the Mission Impossible movies, they generally do not have very big opening weekends, but they have held around and ended up making a lot of money. If I remember right, I want to say like the highest domestic opening for a Mission Impossible movie was like $65, $70 million, somewhere in that range. So I don't think this is too far off what the other ones are. So I think what we'll have to look at is next week, I think it's going to take a big hit because of the other two movies coming out. But then we'll have to see after that if it plateaus and is able to stick around for a while. I think that's ultimately what's going to tell if it's a success or not. In Spider-Man finally falling out of the top five, it seemed like it's been there, you know, since I was in my 20s. But, you know, it's well made. People loved it. And, you know, it was probably the best kids movie out this year. And families just kept taking kids to see it. Like, I know last week when I was going in to see Mission Impossible, there was still a drove of families all there with their kids with little blankets, Spider-Man blankets, ready to see it. Don't know why people are bringing blankets to theaters now, but it is a thing, at least where I live. And The Sound of Freedom is, it's really interesting. It's just like if you, they have found a niche market and they have marketed it to that niche market. And it's like when, you know, someone who's political views, you're like, that guy sounds crazy, but he keeps getting elected over and over and over again. He knows what to say to the people that are voting for him. And this movie knows what to say to the people that it's trying to get out to the theater, and they're doing a good job of it. Now, I think those are my big takeaways for the box office this weekend. So I don't worry so much about Mission Impossible because, like I said, they're generally slow burns money-wise. When I, just like a note for clarity, when I look up the worldwide box office for Rise of the Beast, I'm getting around $500 million. But even if it's only $500 million in for compared to what like Bumblebee did, that is this franchise still heading in the right direction. So, I mean, if it's $900 million, that's a grand slam. But even if it is only the 500 and some odd million, that's still a really solid double for this franchise.
Box office mojo is betraying me here. my general thoughts are, I agree with what both of you guys said. The Mission Impossibles, they have legs. They're slow burns. They earn their money. They're going to be in the top five for the next couple of weeks. It's going to earn its chunks of money, but globally is always where the Mission Impossible franchise makes its dollar. And I mean, I've read every article that is like, well, this is a huge major disappointment. It's like, oh, it debuted lower than Ghost Protocol. That's okay. This is a two-parter. People are interested, to JTE, to your point, people are more interested to see how this ends because this is not an isolated story. Right. These other Mission Impossible movies, they were all isolated stories. They were all isolated adventures of Ethan Hunt's. Yeah. And sure, there was a common thread among them. But at the same time, it wasn't a part one versus a part two. But this is going to have legs. It's going to make its money. The Sound of Freedom. I think the most entertaining thing that comes out of The Sound of Freedom is the stories of like these tortured people going to see this movie. It's like, you're just making more of this than you think. But again, I'm shocked, but at the same time, to your point, Benny, they found the market to be able to market this movie towards. And yeah, this movie is going to have some legs because the fan base that is going to see this is going to repeat view this movie just for a point of making a statement of fact. So, count on The Sound of Freedom being in the top five probably next weekend too. I'm just going to say it. But yeah, I also am, I think the big shocker for me is Little Mermaid still sticking around, still kicking ass, still doing well. So I'm excited for that. I'm a little disappointed. Joyride has not done better. I thought word of mouth might pick that up a little bit. But unfortunately, just it didn't. Folks, if you haven't seen Joyride, it's a hilarious, raunchy, like heartfelt movie. Go see Joyride. That's my little plug for that movie. I enjoyed that movie so freaking much. But I'm hoping, again, it has kind of a late couple of weeks surge where it will come back. But yeah, I mean, overall, Mission Impossible not doing well over the 3-day week. To your point, Benny, I believe that they released it last Tuesday. I think you're correct.
Yeah, I saw it Tuesday night.
Yeah, so they released it Tuesday. Those numbers are kind of a snapshot for how it did like a Friday, Saturday, Sunday, which is where most box office sites take their box office totals for the weekends for that movie. This movie's well over $100 million domestically at this point. It's doing gangbusters internationally. Don't worry, folks. The Mission Impossible franchise is not going anywhere.
If anything, Top Gun bought him like a check for the next 5 years to make whatever he wants. Universal's like, hey, you know what? You made us $1 billion. Whatever you want to make next, go ahead. We're going to allow it. You want to make two more Mission Impossibles, you have an open check here at Paramount.
And folks, we'll eventually see Tom Cruise kill himself on screen. It's going to happen.
Oh, no.
But moving on to our next story, I do think we as a collective group here, we as the three amigos, the fearsome threesome here, we got to talk about the strike that's occurring right now. The Screen Actors Guilds and the writers. The writer strike, excuse me. We need to bring this up. We need to address it on our show, and we need to certainly give our feelings for it. Before we went live and started recording, JT had some thoughts, and we definitely wanted to lead off with you.
Yeah, I'm trying to look at it as like an audience perspective, because obviously me out here in LA, I have friends who are in SAG and Writers Guild, and I fully support what they're doing. I feel like this was a long time coming. I think if you look in the history of Hollywood and like their books, they've always been kind of running them crooked. They always cheat and basically use every trick in the book to make it look like a movie will lose money, so they won't have to pay any money out to the people who worked on it and the actors. So I think this was just a long time coming. It finally hit the crossroads where they had to do something, had to change with streaming, with the way they aren't really, I think, forthcoming with the money and how they cheat the books. I'm not surprised at all this happened. I'm not surprised the studios are being a pain in the ass about it. And I'm not surprised, my friends and people I know. I live about 5 miles from Warner Brothers and Universal Studios and Disney. So I drive around, I see them picking out all the time. I honk my horn. So it's very something that's very in my face right now. But as you know, I think a lot of listeners out there, I also think about, we just got out of COVID. Last year was kind of like, movies came out, but not like they used to before COVID. And I feel like this is the first summer since COVID where it feels like, oh, this is a regular summer movie season where there's a blockbuster coming every weekend, if not every other weekend. And I do feel like you already heard about movies like Deadpool 3, Gladiator 2, have stopped production, mid-production. All those movies are going to get pushed back. All the Marvel movies are probably going to get pushed back. I think this is just going to delay maybe not next year, but definitely the year after. But I think it will also affect next year. I think it's unfortunately going to put cinemas in a little bit of a dry spell just when they're kind of getting back on their feet. And I don't worry for movie going, because I don't think theaters will ever go away. Movie theaters will always have a place in our world and in America. So I'm not worried about that, but I am worried about what movie going will be like and how different it'll be if we don't get back to where we were before COVID. And also this year, you got the fact that like some movies aren't doing as well. Indiana Jones, The Flash, those were, potential $1 billion movies on paper. I think when they made those films, they're like, oh, last Indiana Jones made like $1 billion. This will probably get close. They're not doing that. So there's a lot of ingredients in here that's making a really bad stew. I just hope we come out of it for the better eventually. And I hope, my hope is this, they get to the negotiating table, because it's costing everybody money, not just the people striking, but the studios. Everyone's losing money. And if anything is going to motivate anybody in this world, it's money. So hopefully they can come to a conclusion before the end of the year. And hopefully we'll save next year as far as summer season goes.
How about you, Benny? Your thoughts on the strike?
Well, I guess I don't really have anything personal to add, and that I've never been in a union, so I don't really have a lot of insight as far as unions go. Now, I do find it interesting as far as the Actors Guild go, and even the Writers Guild, and that, you know, a lot of times unions are kind of homogenous, you know, like there are a lot of people that do kind of the same thing, where both of these unions are pretty diverse as far as like what people do. Like, you know, you have Jim, who's been an extra in 45 movies, and then you have a guy that's making $20 million a movie, and they're both in the same union. So it seems interesting. I guess that I don't know how these particular unions settle on what they consider a happy medium or what they're working towards. Because I imagine most of their members are not going to be able to hold out for a 6-8 month strike. Whereas the studios, it would hurt them, but they can sit there for 6 or 8 months if they really want to. So I think it all depends on how much money the studio is willing to lose because of this, because there is a point where if they dig in their heels and say, we're going to screw over these unions, they can probably do that, I would wager. I hope that they don't do that. I do hope that both of these unions stick around enough to get what they want, you know, from a selfish point of view, as far as AI goes, just because in 10 years, I don't want to be watching TV shows that are written by a computer. And I think they're both trying to nip this in the bud early before that happens. And so I'm pulling for both of these units from a selfish perspective, just because I really want them to win that fight regarding artificial intelligence and its inclusion in TV and movies. I still want it to be an art form that's completely human made. If it was up to me, I would enjoy them removing most of the CGI from movies. But I guess those are my very disjointed, uninformed thoughts on the matter.
Disjointed as it was, it was very, very well said. I'll tell you that right now. I'm kind of in the same boat. Like I don't have a ton of information about this. I'm not part of a union myself, but I do know, like, and what I have read seems very unfair to both the actors and the writers that are striking right now, especially when it comes to things like residuals. I've read some of these articles about some of the most popular movies or some of these most popular shows that debut. And then you hear about like the writer, the primary chief writer from that earning like $150 on a residual for that show re-airing again. And it just doesn't seem fair. And I too agree with you with what you have to say, Benny. I mean, from wanting the actors and the writers to definitely win this strike, the whole concept of AI writing entertainment for us just doesn't feel right. And if you go through the vast history of entertainment, both television, movies, podcasts, literature, it's all human written and human driven concepts. And moving forward to like a computer telling us what is funny, what isn't funny, what we would enjoy, what doesn't enjoy, that all just doesn't feel right as a human being itself. So I agree 100% with your statement on that. But also, I want it to be fair across the board. One of my biggest takeaways from this is so many of these CEOs of these large corporations in a strike like this just need to shut the hell up. Honestly, like you read like Bob Iger's comments for Disney. Bob Iger, maybe he's looking at this from an analytical businessman standpoint, but at the same time, it's like, Bob, shut the hell up. Like, you're now public enemy number one, and you're the face of Disney, and you just got a 5-year contract renewal, and the dude makes $20 million a year. Like, somebody made a joke to me the other day, and it was like, how come this guy makes so much money? It's like, if this guy didn't make $20 million a year, like, nobody would want to be the CEO of Disney then. But you just see these studio heads come out and they're like, oh, our studio is losing $600,000 a day. That was one that I read, that Warner Brothers studio was losing $600,000 a day, basically, for every day that the studio went on strike. You know what? Those are numbers you keep to yourself. Because all I hear from that is, you know what? You could just simply sign these guys and you won't lose that money. Like, the CEOs, the studio heads, they really do need to butt out of this, and they really need to buckle down and settle in on the negotiation part of this. That's what needs to happen. It's not about your opinion on the matter. You can voice your opinion behind a closed door. You don't need to be publicly voicing your opinion on this matter unless you're supporting the people who, let's face it, are your bread and butter. They're the people in the trenches. They're the people doing the work. They're the people writing the stories. They're the people acting them out. You need them on your side. All you're doing is alienating yourself by opening your mouth and giving a contrary opinion to what the strike is all about. So that's just my personal opinion. As a businessman myself, I do definitely think, like, if I'm on the other sidelines, I'm not saying a word.
Yeah. And a side note, I think a lot of the residual things is because there's not a definitive mathematical formula for people to get residuals from streaming services, because people pay a lump sum and they get all the entertainment. As a consumer, it is really awful, but I think the most logical solution is to have a pay per show model instead of just having a lump sum model, because there's 800 things, 1,000 things on Netflix that I don't watch. There's about 10 that I do, where if I was paying in my $10 a month to have access to those shows, you know exactly how much in residuals to get people those shows as compared to some other random show. I think that's unfortunately the most logical outcome. Whether or not they're willing to do that, I don't know. Whether or not we as consumers are willing to accept that at this point, but I think that's where it needs to go for it to be fair.
Well, folks, we're going to move on to what we might think could be some cheerful news. For me, it's not, but we're going to be talking about Aquaman. And I don't know if you've tuned in over the last couple of weeks. I'm sure you've listened to my rant over how much I dislike the Aquaman franchise. However, we're going to talk about how Aquaman has fired Batman. In the midst of a third series of reshoots, both Ben Affleck's cameo and Michael Keaton's cameo, where they were both going to reprise their role as Bruce Wayne and Batman, have been cut from these most recent reshoots. The new DC executives, James Gunn and Peter Safran, both came out and said that they did not want to promise a universe to fans that would never come to fruition. So, guys, we already anticipate that Aquaman is going to be a dumpster fire of a movie in what is right now a dumpster fire of a studio in DC Studios. What is your guys' thoughts? And Benny, I'll start with you. What is your thoughts on the departure of Ben Affleck, Michael Keaton as Batman, and certainly the third round of reshoots for Aquaman?
I think they may be looking for a way to save Jason Momoa as Aquaman, to be honest with you, and trying to detach this movie from the old cinematic universe and see if they can find a way to shoehorn it into the new. And that's my initial thought when I heard this, is that they want him not to be a part of the Snyderverse anymore so they can use him, because he's pretty much the most beloved thing that came out of the DCEU as it was. And so I really don't care. Like I said, random cameos don't do much for me at this point in movies unless they're completely out of the blue. And I wouldn't mind Jason Momoa continuing to be Aquaman, because I really enjoyed the first Aquaman. And whether or not this one is going to be a train wreck, I'm going to hold off until I see the movie, because until it's in the can, anything can happen.
Yeah, I'm kind of on optimism with Benny. I don't think this movie's going to be that bad. I think they're reshooting it for the third time, and they're putting more money into it because I think they see they have something, and they're just trying to form it into the best possible. Apparently, the first Aquaman had a lot of issues, and they really kind of fixed them in editing towards the very end of – right before it was released, they had a couple of little reshoots. Now, this sounds a lot more extensive, but I agree. I love Jason Momoa as Aquaman. I trust in James Wan. I don't think he's really failed me yet as far as a filmmaker. I think everything he's done has been pretty good. I really liked the first Aquaman. So my only worry is they're definitely putting a message into this movie because they're really touching on global warming and the dangers it has to aquatic life. And I think there's no message in that first Aquaman movie. It was just pure entertainment, fun, escapism. So maybe they kind of lost their way trying to make like a message movie. I believe they said Momoa even had a hand in coming up with the story for this one. And I don't know if I want Jason Momoa to come up with my stories. I love the guy. Still doesn't mean he's a great, you know, screenwriter or storyteller. So maybe they bit off more than they could chew. But the fact that they are spending another 20, 30, whatever million they're spending for these reshoots, the third round, my hope is they're able to save it and just at the very least have an entertaining, fun Christmas blockbuster. And I want to see this movie with Moose because I think that would be a fun screening.
I'm totally down to see it. And honestly, actually hearing both of your guys' comments, I'm going to be a little more optimistic. I was going to go in and be like, oh, this is going to be the worst movie. But while Benny and you were both speaking, the first thing that came to mind was the movie Rogue One. Rogue One had three rounds of reshoots. They put more money into it. And I remember reading the stories and being like, oh, my God, this movie is going to be awful. Rogue One is my favorite Star Wars movie. Full stop.
I was going to say, it's my favorite of the new films.
Nope.
For sure.
Full stop.
Okay.
I love Rogue One. And so hearing your guys' comments about this, actually, okay, I'm a little optimistic. And I will say this. While I do not like the Aquaman movie in the DCEU, I do like Momoa as Aquaman. It's very hard to turn Aquaman into the coolest guy on the team, right? He's a guy that talks to fish. He lives in the water. Like, the one thing that the Flash kind of joked around was like, okay, so he's just a strong mermaid. Arguably, like, Aquaman is the coolest guy in the Justice League. And you have to give a lot of credit to that, to the casting of Jason Momoa. They got this cool dude. He's a hairy guy. He's got all the tattoos going on for him. He's not just the fish guy, you know, with the scales. Like, he is legitimately a cool contender. So I'd be all on board if Momoa was one of the few layovers from this iteration of the DCU, and they kept him as Aquaman in the new one. Who knows? Maybe these reshoots are including Blue Beetle. We know that Blue Beetle is going to be the first of the new version of the DC movies. And so maybe cutting out both Affleck and Keaton was like, hey, look, we did all of this in The Flash. That didn't work for us. There's a chance we could keep Momoa. There's a chance we could salvage this movie. We're already probably $250 million budgeted towards this movie. So maybe we invest a little bit more. We slow down. We do some reshoots. We include some extra scripts. Maybe you throw in a Blue Beetle cameo, and then there is your link to the previous DC universe. So, you know what? After hearing your guys' points, I'm gonna do a 360 and say, you know what? Good for them. All right, folks, we are going to take a break. Up next, we rank our Mission Impossible franchise movies. Stick around.
There are many things you have never seen nor heard. This will change your experience. Introducing the Fisher Audio Video System Model 1500 with 150 watt per channel stereophonic sound. Laser compact disc player. State-of-the-art video cassette recorder. Linear tracking turntable. Dual cassette deck. 15-inch three-way bass reflex speaker systems. And 400-line high-resolution TV picture. This new advanced system will bring you incredible pictures and sounds. You will see and hear with a clarity and vividness that until now were only a fantasy of science. The Fisher Audio Video System. It will alter your view of the world.
Welcome back, folks. We really, really do have the best sponsors in the biz. Now is our favorite segment, where every week we always throw a little extra butter on your movie-going popcorn. And this week, the three of us are going to break down what is probably going to go down in history as the greatest action franchise, and that is the Mission Impossible franchise. As of right now, there's 7 movies in this franchise. We're going to rank them last place to first place, and we're going to give our reasons why. Now, I'm going to start with JT, because JT is our action aficionado here. This man, you can cut him, and he bleeds action, okay? So we need to start with JTE. Yeah. Take it away. Bottom to top, buddy. What do you got?
So I've seen all these movies in theaters. I think I've seen all of them at least twice in theaters. I don't think I ever just watched one of these movies once. I love this series. This is one of my all-time favorite series. I just think they're amazing. So let's go ahead. In last place. And one caveat. I'm sorry. I like all these movies. You know, sometimes sure. It hurts me to put some of these movies, even the bottom movie, I could go watch it right after this podcast and I'd have a really good time. So the ranking for me is just personal taste. And I do think it comes down to, I mean, a lot of these movies are made by directors with signature styles. And I think for me, the last place is the original Mission Impossible, because I think Brian De Palma is not an action director. He did a pretty good action movie, though, with this film. But I think the parts in the first Mission Impossible that work better are the more thriller aspect, you know, the tension. So it's not quite the action franchise I want it to be. After that, I'm going to go with number 6, Mission Impossible 2. I'm a huge John Woo fan. I think a lot of people probably have Mission Impossible 2 last. Not me, buddy, because this is the movie that where it became a summer blockbuster. Like the first film, great spy thriller. Part 2 is unadulterated John Woo action cinema, lens through a Tom Cruise long-haired A-list actor. I love Part 2. I think it's one of the more best looking films in the entire series. Cinematography, music by Hans Zimmer. Oh, so good. Next after that, I'm going with Dead Reckoning Part 1. Now, I feel like everything after Mission Impossible 2 is just excellent. All these movies are just excellent. I really like this film. I thought Dead Reckoning Part 1, and the reason why I have it at the fifth place is because it is a Part 1, and I wonder if my feelings will change once I see Part 2, and I kind of think of it more as one movie. But it's still, at 2 hours, 46 minutes, it's one movie. So it's not Lord of the Rings, okay? This is still Mission Impossible. After that, I'm going to go Rogue Nation. I really like Rogue Nation. Great scene at the opera. But I do think the ending doesn't quite live up to what came before it. The ending kind of ends with like people at a table in front of a cafe. A tense moment, but not the action extravaganza that I think some of the later films give you. After the Rogue Nation, my top 3, at number 3, I'm going to go Mission Impossible 3. I think J.J. Abrams put so much energy into this movie that it really feels like a thrill ride roller coaster. The scene on the bridge with the drone has got some very memorable shots. And again, to me, Mission Impossible 3 is maybe the most kinetic-based pacing of all the films. It is just nonstop, and it feels like what a summer blockbuster should be in the 2000s. And then my top 2, and these are the top 2 are the ones I really struggled with, because I think these are the 2 best films in the series. For number 2, I'm going to go Ghost Protocol, which is the 4th film in the franchise. Brad Bird, the Dubai scene, I think is still maybe the best stunt scene of all the films. I just love that whole sequence right into the sandstorm. And I actually really like the ending of this movie. I think the party scene that goes into this weird car garage and there's like cars falling, I just loved that movie from beginning to end. And it added more humor, I think, than any other films, and actually pulled it off more than the other films. So to me, Ghost Protocol is like almost a perfect mix of summer fun, but also a serious action stunt movie. And then to me, Fallout is number 1 because it felt like the filmmaking reached another level. It felt like Jeff Snyder kind of compared it to The Dark Knight, as like seeing a comic book movie made with almost like every department on the top of their game. Set design, production, effects, acting, pacing, like editing. I think Fallout is the best of all those different compartments of what a film has to offer. All comes together perfectly in Fallout. I love Fallout. I think it's the best of the series, so I have that number 1.
How about you, Benny? Start us off at the bottom and take us to the top.
All right. So my list is pretty simple. As JTE guessed, I think the worst one is Part 2. Like, I know JTE is a John Woo apologist, but, you know, I'm not a fan of Hard Target. And, you know, so I'll take a pass on most John Woo movies, to be honest with you.
Do not tell that to Mark Ellis. He will disown you.
Fair enough. I won't. I'll keep it quiet. But, again, I didn't feel that there was any chemistry between Tom Cruise and fake Rosario Dawson, whose name I can't remember.
Sandy Newton. Sandy
Newton. Respect on her name. Yeah, so I didn't think there was any chemistry between them. And to be honest, it was forgettable to the point I don't even remember the plot or why they were doing it. So to me, it was just a completely forgettable random action movie. It wasn't bad. It was just forgettable. Then after that, part one, I'm not a spy movie person, but I would say it is good enough that, 30 years later now, I can still remember scenes from that movie. And it's a movie that I've watched twice and, isn't my cup of tea. So it is good to test the time on some level. And then after that, my rankings get really simple. They just go in order. So from 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. So I will say this. I will get into why I have the most recent movie, number one. But I think they've gotten a little better and a little less serious with each with subsequent in each film, which I think is needed. One thing I do worry about is right now I think they're in that sweet spot of action, comedy, seriousness, like blending together. But at times they're taking like the action to like absurd levels where you're getting to those fast and furious levels where it's becoming cartoonish. And so I worry that the series is about ready to jump the shark. But I think each successive film, they've gotten closer to the sweet spot, and they're right there now. And I don't know how long they can stay there, but I'm curious to see.
I, too, am going to start at the bottom with Mission Impossible 2. It doesn't feel like an Ethan Hunt movie. I understand that it's a one-off adventure. It's like Avengers Age of Ultron. It wasn't part of the whole, like, story. It was just an Avengers story. Fine. It doesn't age well as far as I'm concerned. I like you, Benny. I'm like, wait, what happened to Thandie? She's just a one-and-done broad? Like, that's not fair to Thandie. I don't know. Mission Impossible, actually, I was invested after the first one. When I was a kid, my dad watched Mission Impossible all the time. So when these movies came out, I saw the first Mission Impossible in theaters with my dad. And I remember being like, this is really cool because we used to watch this, B-list show. And now it's a very A-list, type movie. And so I was very excited for the second one and disappointed. So I actually didn't, because of that, I didn't see Mission Impossible 3 in theaters. I didn't see Mission Impossible 3 until a couple of years ago.
Oh, wow.
Because I was checked out of that, but I just kept hearing how good the Mission Impossible series continued to get. So Mission Impossible 2 turned me off of the Mission Impossible franchise. So it's dead last. Mission Impossible 1 is next. Dead Reckoning Part 1. Is after that. And like JTE said, I like all of these movies. Don't get me wrong. There is only Mission Impossible 2 is the one that I'm not a huge fan of. All the rest of these, I can sit down and watch these at any point in time. And so ranking them as low as I do, there's a little sting that comes to it. Like, well, I like this movie. It's not that I don't. It's just I like this next one better. So Dead Reckoning is going to be third from the bottom. Then Ghost Protocol. Then Rogue Nation. My number two is Mission Impossible 3. When I did finally see Mission Impossible 3, man, I dug Mission Impossible 3. And you nailed it when you said that J.J. Abrams put everything he had energy-wise into making that movie. And that movie is great. And realistically speaking, that could have been the end of the Mission Impossible franchise. Tom Cruise quits the IMF at the end of the movie. He's about to get married, says his goodbyes to his friends. But what it did instead was it introduced us to far cooler characters. And now Ethan Hunt has more than just the world on the line. He has a wife that is also on the line. So I very much dug Mission Impossible 3. It got me back into the Mission Impossible franchise. I think it's a stellar outing and Fallout. Come on. Who isn't going to put Fallout number one? Who isn't going to put Henry Cavill cocking his arms like guns, loading them up to go into the fight? it's such the perfect Mission Impossible movie. And I'm a big fan of like detective movies. And there's always an element of detective movies in the Mission Impossible franchise. There's always an element of solving the problem, having your team and working the problem. And that's always what Mission Impossible franchise is. But Fallout has that level of he's just one step more than the villain is. I almost put Rogue Nation at number one purely because of the scenes between Tom Cruise and what is his name? Sean Harris.
Alec Baldwin?
No.
Oh, no, no, the villain, yeah.
The villain, yes, because the villain is in these movies, he's the smartest guy in the room, but then he's really not at the end. And I love that fact. It's always like the, the Hercules Poirot's, the Sherlock Holmes movies. He's not really the smartest man in the room. Ethan Hunt is. And Fallout, it takes him to the brink, but he finally wins at the end of Fallout. And then you finally get the closure of his wife has moved on. It's okay for Cruz and Rebecca Ferguson to have something. And so you're not quite going like, well, wait a minute, isn't Tom Cruise married? No, they put that to rest, and I'm glad that they finally put that to rest because that was came up a couple of times in my head in like Rogue Nation, and I actually did enjoy the end of Ghost Protocol when they're all sitting in the bay, and he finally relieves Jeremy Renner of that burden of having killed Ethan Hunt's wife, and it's like no, he just relocated her again. Ethan Hunt being the smartest guy in the room. So yeah, Fallout, Mission Impossible 3, Rogue Nation, Ghost Protocol, Dead Reckoning Part 1, Mission Impossible 1, Mission Impossible 2. Now's the time to air your grievances, boys.
Let me defend Mission Impossible 2 just a little bit more.
Please do.
You watch 3 and on, Tom Cruise is a veteran. He is like the MVP of the league. He is the guy that the Mission Impossible, IMF, whatever they're called, He's amazing. Mission Impossible 2 is like when LeBron was taking the Cavs to the playoffs single-handedly. He is just a young spy in his prime, martial arts, slow motion, knife an inch from his eye. To me, it is just him and like has his most everything comes easy to him in a way. It's just he's at his peak. He is the American version of James Bond at that point. And I understand, I think people like, because after that film, J.J. Abrams reintroduced the team aspect. And that team aspect has carried on for the films going forward. So I kind of like 2 as my James Bond, a.k.a. American Ethan Hunt. To me, that is a Bond movie if Bond was American. And to me, that was just Ethan Hunt when he was just absolutely at his best. And everything after that is him in a more, I guess you could say, grounded version. It's hard to even say that because there's some fantastical things. But the reason I buy everything he does in all those other Mission Impossible movies is because I remember the guy who starred in Mission Impossible 2. That guy could do anything. And that's why, to me, Mission Impossible 2, and I just think John Woo is a great director, especially action. I could watch that movie just for the action scenes. The motorcycle stuff is like really impressive, and there's not a lot of CGI in that movie. It is ground practical effects because John Woo doesn't know how to shoot with CGI, especially back then. So to me, I could go back and watch it just on that level. But I will also say the series does a good job of hiding their CGI and make everything look like very much is happening in the real world. Obviously, he does all his own stunts in all these movies. And the biggest thing that probably part 2 is missing is that big stunt, that big, oh my God, I can't believe he's doing that. Although, when that knife comes a centimeter from his eye, that's real. They created a rig that was like made in like, it was like a huge machine that was made so no matter what they did, that knife wouldn't go any lower, and it goes right up into his eye. So that is a pretty impressive stunt. Check out the special features on Mission Impossible 2. They have a whole segment on that. That's my defense of Mission Impossible 2. I think this whole series is amazing. I think, Mission Impossible 3, introducing Philip Seymour Hoffman, was awesome.
Yes.
I think he definitely, when you say the villain from Rogue Nation to Fallout, he is probably the most well-known villain just because he carried over to 2 movies and he was very like the guy who knew everything that was happening, like you said, Moose. But Phil Seymour Hoffman comes in and lays that SmackDown pretty hard in part three. That opening to part three is probably one of the best openings of any action movie. So I agree. Part three has a lot of great stuff in it. But to me, like Fallout and Ghost Protocol, it's like at that point, they just figured it out. I think part three, they were still figuring it out a little bit. And by the time we got to Ghost Protocol, I felt like they just figured it out and they knew exactly what they're doing. And Brad Bird's a great director. I mean, especially, you know, obviously animated, but he did a really good job of that film. And I just go back and watch that film and have a blast from beginning to end. Rogue Nation, I think, brings it down to a little bit more serious level. And I can't wait to talk about Dead Reckoning because I think Dead Reckoning reminded me more of the first Mission Impossible in a lot of ways than all these other sequels. But I'll get into that later.
It's very rare that a franchise that has, at this point, seven movies in its stable has so many late entries getting better and better and better. It's such a unique thing. And you have to give credit to the directors, to the writers, Tom Cruise's involvement. Obviously, this is his child. This is his baby right here, this franchise. And we've all heard the rants that occurred during Dead Reckoning Part 1. But as asshole-ish as that was of Tom Cruise, you also see the passion that he has for this franchise. And it shows on screen. And so that's why I trust that the more and more the Mission Impossible movies go on, the more and more quality they're going to get. I do agree that Dead Reckoning was way too long. There was a couple of times in the movies where I was like, oh my God, like we still have like 45 minutes left to go. So as entertaining as it was and as action packed and as much as there was included in there, it was way too long, but we'll talk about that more into the spoilers. But I will just say, this is my favorite action franchise. I mentioned it earlier. I like a good detective story. And at his heart, Ethan Hunt is a detective. He's working the problem with his team. I like the team element far more than Ethan Hunt just being on his own. But Benny, final thoughts on the Mission Impossible franchise as a whole?
I think one of the reasons that it's held up so well is in a lot of ways you can view it as two separate franchises. You have the early movies and the later movies. The earlier ones in a lot of ways feel like a trial run to figure out what the franchise is going to be. And whereas it's not one of my favorite movies in the franchise, obviously, but I think Mission Impossible 3 with Philip Seymour Hoffman, I think is the most important movie in the franchise by far. Philip, the other movies, they seem very, the first two movies to me, even though they're series, they seem campy. They almost feel dated in a way. Whereas Philip Seymour Hoffman created like a villain where there was real tension and you really bought in. So to me, that's the first Mission Impossible movie where I felt like I was actually being sucked into the movie as just opposed to watching the movie to get through it. I don't know if that makes any sense, but to me, that's the most important movie of the franchise. And like I said, they have consistently gotten better. And I think there's only one bad movie out of the seven. And that's as someone that does not particularly care for spy movies.
Let me say one last thing. I think this franchise doesn't rely on villains like a lot of other action franchises do. Part four is my second favorite film of the franchise, Ghost Protocol. And it might have the weakest villain of all the movies. He's just like a no-name Russian dude with a beard. I don't even remember his name. He's just somebody who wanted to blow up the world, basically. It's more about the situations that the teams are put in. The odds are against them and how Ethan Hunt is always able to get out of these crazy situations. So, and I would argue, once again, one of the best villains outside of Philip Seymour Hoffman. We were never scared of Philip Seymour Hoffman. We were scared of him because what he might do, but not physically. He was never going to go toe-to-toe with Tom Cruise. And when he does, it's because Tom Cruise has like a bug about to go off in his head and explode him. And Cruise was still able to elbow his ass to the ground. even the guy in Rogue Nation, he never really got to go, you know, mano a mano with Tom Cruise. He was more of an orchestrated villain. I argue Duggery Scott in Mission Impossible 2 is the only guy who held his own one-on-one fight to the death, old school style. Because if you remember Mission Impossible 2, Dougray Scott would like, whenever they couldn't get a hold of Tom Cruise, he was like his stand-in. He would put his mask on, and he was the closest that could come to Ethan Hunt. So when one thing I enjoy about Mission Impossible 2 is seeing him going against somebody that's close to his level as far as skills and deadliness and, you know, just straight up badass. So, and he hasn't really gotten that since. And in some ways, they touch about that in the new film. Well, I'll talk about that in the next review. So once again, me standing up for Mission Impossible 2.
I mean, look, all I see when I look at Dougray Scott is a failed Wolverine. That's all I see. Well, folks, we're going to wrap up. We're going to head into our next segment, which is our review and spoilers for Mission Impossible Dead Reckoning Part 1. If you've not seen the movie, I highly suggest going out and seeing it, then revisit our review. We'll be back in just a minute, folks.
Get your skis shined up, grab a stick of juicy fruit. The taste is gonna move ya. Take a sniff, pull it out. The taste is gonna move ya when you pop it in your mouth. Juicy fruit is gonna move ya. You chew so soft, it gets right to ya. Juicy fruit, the taste is gonna move ya.
Dickie Greenleaf, it's Tom.
How do you do?
When you can look but not touch.
I wish I could live Dickie's life for him.
When you can dream, but never be accepted.
You could hardly expect this to go on forever.
Anything can happen. Matt Damon, Gwyneth Paltrow, Jude Law.
I always thought it'd be better to be a fake somebody than a real nobody.
The talented Mr. Ripley, rated R. Christmas Day in theaters everywhere.
Welcome back, folks. Well, now we're going to talk about The Running Man's latest entry, Mission Impossible, Dead Reckoning Part 1. Almost said Ghost Protocol, because we were just talking about how good that movie was. But Dead Reckoning Part 1, folks, and we will do non-spoilers at first. We're going to give our general reactions after our first viewing of this. I've gone to JTE a bunch, so Benny, I'm going to start off with you. What's your general reaction and thoughts about Dead Reckoning Part 1?
When we did our rankings, I had this ranked as my favorite Mission Impossible movie. And so obviously, you know, I enjoyed it quite thoroughly. To JTE's point, I think this is the first time that I ever felt like I had a villain that could go physically and mentally toe-to-toe with Ethan Hunt, which was greatly appreciated. And in this movie, I thought they took a step back from the, and maybe the right word is intensity, where they wanted everything to feel intense and high stake. There was a lot of humor and silliness in the movie, which to me, I really appreciated. A lot of times, like, I find the Mission Impossible movies just to not be broken up with any kind of humor. It's just on to the next huge stunt, on to the next big showdown. So the fact that there were these little moments of levity throughout the movie, I really enjoyed it. Helped the movie just feel like a lot smoother watch for me. And in the end, even though it's a part one, I thought it had a pretty satisfying and definite conclusion of a movie. So overall, I really enjoyed it. It's a solid summer action movie. Like I said, spy movies aren't necessarily my thing. It's not something I'm going to revisit a ton, but it's definitely worth a good night out at the theater. You won't be disappointed. You'll leave entertained and laughing.
How about you, JT? What's your thoughts of Dead Reckoning Part 1?
Yeah, listen, when I was in the theater, I was having a great time. These movies are summer blockbusters of the highest order, in my opinion. Although, the funny thing is, and this is not a spoiler because this was in the trailer, they brought back Kittredge from the first Mission Impossible movie. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if you remember, but a lot of people left the first Mission Impossible movie a little confused and a little bit like, I'm not sure what happened here or there. And while no point was I confused, the dialogue heaviness of the first film felt like it was brought into this film. This felt like a marriage of what the first film was and what McQuarrie has been doing with the last two films. So in some ways, it did remind me a lot of Mission Impossible 1, where there's scenes of extensive dialogue, exposition, Whereas I feel like in the past films, there's something we got to get. We got to go get it. So-and-so's doing this. Why? Because he's bad. This movie is definitely trying to be something a little bit more than that. It's much more layered. It's much more complex, I think, than the last, honestly, any of the Mission Impossible films up until the first one. So in a lot of ways, this reminded me, and there's even scenes where he uses the Dutch angle that Brian De Palma used in the original film. And McQuarrie was kind of copying those same shots during certain scenes in this film. And I was like, man, and if you guys remember when we did my rankings, I had the original Mission Impossible dead last. So, but this is nowhere near, this is still a huge spectacle of an action film, but it is much more dense and much more serious than I feel like some of the past films. I actually disagree with Benny. I think there was some humor in this, but I don't think it was anywhere near as lighthearted and humor filled as Ghost Protocol or even Mission Impossible 3. I think McQuarrie definitely made it more serious with Rogue Nation of Fallout. And I feel like he took that seriousness and the denseness of the plot to a whole nother level with this movie, to the point where I feel like even though I enjoyed Fallout and it's my favorite film, I never had to think too hard about what was happening. There's times in this movie where I was like, I need to pay attention because I'm kind of losing what's happening right here. Because this is, sometimes they would talk about something and I'm like, I think they're working at three different levels right now and I'm just trying to follow one of them. So I really enjoyed the film. I think the action sequences are amazing. I think the pacing is amazing. I think the production is amazing. Story-wise, it was a little bit harder to follow than some of the past films and a little more denser than the past films. But I feel bad giving it a complete grade because it is a part one of a part two. And this might be one of those cases where I like it more after I see part two. But at the same time, like Benny said, I do think they made it feel like a whole film. I didn't feel like Fast X when I was left with somebody standing in front of a dam about to explode, like, dun-dun-dun, next week, what will happen? It did feel complete, but at the same time, there's a lot more to mine here in the second film, and I'm curious to see how they pull it off.
So some of the things that you disliked were actually some of the things that I like. I like a little dialogue in between action
sequences. A little. I agree. This is a lot.
But there's so much of the, like, IMF lore that is really unexplained or really unexplored in the Mission Impossible franchise. It's just this agency that exists. And to your point, JT, a lot of the movies is like, oh, we got to go get this to get this guy to do this. Got it. Let's go. So I actually enjoyed a lot of the like dialogue, especially some of the earlier conversations where it's just all the heads of all the different agencies. That whole scene right there with bringing back, I'm sorry,
Kittredge.
What was the Kittredge? Thank you. That whole scene was so awesome. And of course, some of the setup for me was very obvious, but they really stretched out getting to some of the sequences. Like in that particular scene, as awesome as it was, we all know it was freaking Tom Cruise in the mask. So I won't go into too much spoilers. I'll do my rant on the next segment of it. But some of the sequences that you knew were going to happen, they took too long happening. You either saw it in previews, you either, or it was just heavily, heavily alluded to, and the whole stretched out sequence to finally get to that payoff. So the movie felt long to me. I will say this, as much as I enjoyed it, the movie felt long. I remember looking at my wife and being like, we still have 45 minutes left in this movie. and I liked some of the newer characters that they introduced. I think Hayley Atwell was great. I think Pom Klentleaf was outstanding in this role. And I agree with you guys about the villain. It's not just AI. It's AI has chosen. It's like it's avatars, the people who are going to be the physical persona or represent the AI. And so the villain Gabriel throughout the movie, intelligent, physically imposing, like a fun villain to go up against Ethan Hunt and his team. And then the whole idea of the movie, like there's nothing that you can do that will outthink this. So you have to do things differently. It's kind of the like core concept of this movie, because it's dealing with basically like humanity versus AI. Right. And that's not a spoiler. That's very obvious this movie.
Yeah. It's in, they definitely allude to AI in the trailer, but let's just get right into spoilers from here on out, because I feel like to really talk about this movie, you got to get in the spoilers. And I think the AI thing, not a spoiler, but the depth of how far it goes is very interesting, because
yes,
this movie opens with like a Hunt for Red October style submarine sequence, which reminded me of like Crimson Tide or some of these older films from the 90s. U571, like there hasn't been a good submarine movie in a long time. And I love to have that opening where usually you get Tom Cruise in that opening scene. And we are kind of brought into a scene that has nothing to do with him, nothing to do with any of the IMF. It is almost like a standalone short scene from another movie. It could have been Shia LaBeouf's Eagle Eye for all we care, because that's like what they're touching upon. And I thought that was a really cool opening sequence. And I was like, oh man, interesting to not open this with any of the IMF crew. You're not opening it with Tom Cruise. You're opening it with something that's just kind of like, hey, here's an event that will lead to everything that's going to happen to this movie. And I think it was a large leap of faith for him to make your villain something that you can't see, can't communicate with. It is literally 2001: A Space Odyssey. It is AI becoming self-aware. It is Skynet, but in a much different way than all those other movies. And the way he uses humans as like their avatars. And I do think the movie at times is a little murky. I'm not 100% sure why he's doing what the entity wants to do, except for the fact that some people just want to watch the world burn. And I think that's where you're supposed to kind of come away with the main villain in this film. He's just bad for the sake of being bad. He's just not a good guy. And that, like, how did the AI communicate with him? How did it hire him? How did it go and hire Palm? Like, there's a lot of questions I have that I feel like they could have done a better job of elaborating on and getting us to a point where I'm like, oh, that's what these bad guys are up to. Where, once again, it feels like he's just bad. And this AI says, hey, with me, you'll rule the world, I guess? Or doesn't even want to rule the world. He just wants to burn it all down. I have some trouble there. Did that make sense to either of you guys? Were you able to pull like his motivations to work with this AI, the entity, which it is called?
Yeah, and I'm sure that they're going to explore his character because he was quite a standout in the film. I'm sure you'll get a little more reasoning in the next one. Again, this is a part one. You know, if you remember, and like we were all wondering why Thanos was after the stones, you know, and then they finally do a little bit of backstory in the Infinity War saga, you know, to kind of explain the. So I do believe like a good villain is introduced to just a, you know, a brute force. And then you can explore a little bit of their motives. But he did it a couple of times mention that like he was at this point partnering with the entity because it was like better to be the right hand of God than be in its wake. And so I think that he knows, and this, what the AI gave him too, was complete and utter access to almost anything. The guy, the sequence where he's walking through the airport, but his body is like visibly disappearing. That's just one thing. Like imagine that you're just ruthless contract killer. Right. And the only way that really you can get around in this world is very secretively, but now you don't have that handcuff anymore.
Good point. Yeah,
you're kind of completely free to be just this menacing force in the world. And if you were approached, and again, I fully anticipate that we're going to get the sequence between Gabriel and the entity in the next one that will very much sum up like how contact was initiated and why Gabriel was chosen. But obviously, the entity fears Ethan Hunt the most, and Gabriel has a history with Ethan Hunt. So the entity for sure targeted Gabriel because Ethan Hunt was framed for murder that Gabriel committed. Spoiler alert, the whole idea behind the IMF is they're taking people from basically serving life sentences in prison and giving this opportunity to them, work for us, and you choose to accept these missions or you're going to go straight to prison. Those are your options. So I found the like expanding lore of the IMF like incredibly interesting. But yeah, I think that Gabriel will be fully fleshed out by the end of this saga.
Yeah, and that's a great point. I really feel like I need to see this movie again because I saw it Tuesday the night it came out, which we're recording this a little bit later than usual. So it's been a week since I've seen the movie. And because I feel like there's so much going on and so many stories and interweaving espionage, I feel like I need to see it again because everything you said, as you say, I was remembering it. I was like, oh yeah, that is why. And I'm just, it was hard at 2 hours and 46 minutes. It was hard for me to take everything in and remember everything outside of the action sequences, which we'll talk about some more. So I do agree with it. So they did do a pretty good job explaining it. And I look forward to watching it again and trying to pick up a little bit more on second viewing, because again, I said this in my initial review, I think it is kind of a dense film, more so than the other films.
Benny, what's your thought about the villain? Let's just go into our thoughts about Gabriel. I mean, I personally thought, and Benny, you kind of hinted at it earlier, that the villain in this one might be the greatest adversary that Tom Cruise is facing, not just the entity, the AI portion of it, but also the character of Gabriel. What are your thoughts on both entity and Gabriel?
I really liked Gabriel. He came across really as just like this cold-blooded assassin. And whenever there's a cold-blooded assassin in the movie, he's always the coolest character in the movie. And I think he did a great job of pulling that off. I think some of the peripheral of him was a little odd. Like, I don't really know what I can't pronounce her last. Clementief. I don't really understand the purpose of her character in the movie. Like, she did not need to be there, the character as a whole. And
wow, I thought she was a highlight. I'm surprised to hear that. Yeah. She's just a hired gun assassin, a badass assassin. But keep going.
And I wish the entity, I really like that there's this, it's essentially the Terminator without a body, so he's chosen a human body. And I really like that dynamic. It takes it into like a sci-fi realm that it didn't really have a place to go to before, which I really enjoyed as far as the villain goes. At times, they would kind of represent it as a screensaver from the 90s in the background. Yeah. I really wish they had not done that.
Yep,
I think that took away from it. but overall, I really like that Gabriel, for the most part, was calm. The calm villain is always the scariest villain in a movie. And up until like that last 5 minutes of the movie, he legitimately always felt like he was ahead of Tom Cruise and that he was always willing to go one step further than a normal villain would go. So overall, I really appreciated the villain's performance.
There's a quote that about the Quiet Man, and they featured it on the beginning of the movie Vice. And ever since then, I've always been obsessed with this quote. But the quote is, "Beware the Quiet Man, for while others speaks, he watches. While others acts, he plans. And when they finally rest, he strikes." And I think that kind of sums up this character of Gabriel as a villain. And that is almost a polar opposite to Tom Cruise as Ethan Hunt. So I love the dynamic between these two villains. And to defend Palm, I also thought she was a bit of a standout for me. She almost had very little dialogue, but like the expression and like the brutality that she brought to the role, she basically had to create this character with just facial expressions. And it made it so fascinating. And at the one point when she's wearing like the kabuki makeup, the choices, if you're going to a dress up party and you choose to dress like that, like just purely because you're the villain and you can, like, I don't know. I thought she was a standout. I actually enjoyed like the physicality of it. And then, a little spoiler for the end. She's obviously not. Yeah, she's obviously not dead, right? She was stabbed in the chest. They said she still had a heartbeat. And so I don't think that she's going to be dead. I think that she'll be another IMF recruit for Tom Cruise and his team. I actually would enjoy that quite a bit if they do choose to expand on her role and not just make her a one-off in Dead Reckoning Part 1. However, her flip was a little too convenient. She went from trying to kill Tom Cruise, and I understand, fine, he didn't kill her in the alley. And that alley sequence was top-notch freaking action sequence. Just the tiny little corridor and the two baddies versus Ethan Hunt, and they're duking it out. I understand her flip, and I understand the reasonings for it. It was just too convenient, and it was too easy for her. This is a person who drove like a tank through Rome.
And she looked crazy doing it too.
Yes, looking just like an insane person, killing countless
poor, you know, innocent bystanders along the way, to just being all of a sudden very altruistic and, okay, you know what? He saved my life. Therefore, I'm going to save him. Like, that part for me didn't 100% work, although her character did.
It's so funny you say you don't. She might not be dead. I thought they made it pretty clear that she died, but now, again, I need to watch this movie again. I thought she, like, literally died in his hands.
Yeah, there were the two detectives who were following Cruz everywhere, right?
Yep.
The one guy was taking her pulse, and he's like, I've got a pulse. It's faint, though.
Oh, okay, yeah. So that makes sense.
Yeah, again, it being a part one of a part two, it's like, okay, so she'll be back in part two. Got it.
Well, that's interesting because I think the two women we need to talk about are Hayley Atwell and Rebecca Ferguson.
Yes.
First of all, Rebecca Ferguson, loved her in the last two films.
Yes.
She was one of the best things in Rogue Nation, and I was so happy they brought her back for Fallout. And this movie, we unfortunately, it looks like 100% to me she's dead. She has that fight with Gabriel, and you felt it. You felt that she was going to lose. You knew she was going to die. Just the way the movie built up to that fight scene, you just knew she was going to die. And I just, the whole time I'm watching that fight, I'm like, I had my hand over my eyes. I was like, she's going to get killed. I was like, because this is part one. I was like, they're not going to have this fight after that whole speech he gave. There's no way she's living through this. I was like, are they actually going to do it? And they did it. I had a little bit of mixed reaction. I didn't want to see her go. I love her in this franchise. I liked the relationship that she had with Ethan. And I heard some people complain online, you know, it's not fair to do that to give Ethan Hunt motivation. Because I think we could all agree the one thing Ethan Hunt doesn't need is motivation. Because that guy is a energizer bunny. He is just will not stop until he gets the mission done. But I guess that maybe they did to make it more personal revenge kind of aspect to it, but I don't know. Sitting with it now, I still kind of wish they didn't kill her off. And Hayley Atwell, kind of in some way, like, is, I guess, is gonna take her place in this. She's like gonna be part of the new team by the end of the movie. They really pretty much give her the same speech. Hey, you're gonna be wanted wherever you go, you'll probably die. Join the IMF. She's nowhere near as skilled as Rebecca Ferguson. Like, she can't really fight, she's just a thief. So it doesn't really feel like they're replacing her, but it felt a little bit like that when I was watching the movie. I was like, I love Hayley. Well, I thought she was great in this movie, but man, I kind of want Rebecca Ferguson to at least make it to part two. Did you guys feel similar, or were you okay with it?
I was fine with the fight. I appreciated the fight that they had quite a bit. Yeah. I am kind of confused as to the purpose of killing the character off. It just seemed like you could have had the same story with just Rebecca Ferguson's character all the way throughout, or just Hayley Atwell's character all the way throughout. It didn't really feel like you needed both of them. And in a lot of ways, it did feel like, okay, we got to kill her off so we can give Hayley Atwell her spot. And it made sense within the story of the movie, but it also felt like you could have written it and just had one actress all the way throughout. So I don't think it took away from the movie, and I really enjoyed Rebecca Ferguson. So I too would have wished she had stuck in around, but in the end, I think it worked within the movie, so I didn't really have any issues with it.
I guess it does raise the stakes because he killed one of the main team members. So it does raise the stakes in some way. I thought Simon Pegg was going to die like 2-3 times in this movie. I thought he was going to die in the beginning when he was defusing the bomb in the airport. I looked over at my girlfriend. I was like, they're about to kill Simon Pegg. Like, they're going to raise the stakes right in the beginning. Like, nobody's safe. And he actually survived. And I kept thinking he was going to die. So when Rebecca Ferguson died, I was like, oh, man. Are they going to kill the whole team by the end of this movie? Like, what is going to happen?
So I'm with you guys in that I saw that happening. Not at first. In the beginning, and the whole like opening segment with Rebecca Ferguson, where they're in the middle of the desert and she's sniping the like guys on the horses that are chasing Tom Cruise. What a cool freaking sequence that was. She's got the eye patch on so she could see better through the scope. Like, that whole process was cool. I would have been perfectly fine with them revealing that Tom Cruise helped her escape and she's just not in the movie until Dead Reckoning Part 2.
Yeah, I agree.
That would have been a much, much better, because I enjoy her as Ilsa Faust. I think that's such a fun, like, energetic, like, action-packed character. Cool. And she's just, yeah, and she's just a cool, badass female hero. It did feel like it was like, okay, well, out with the old, in with the new. That was kind of my whole take when they killed off Rebecca Ferguson. And I saw it coming because her and Ethan were having these tender moments. And mm-hmm. when she shows up and she's in the truck, she just turns back and winks. It's like, oh, you're dead. Yep. You just knew that this was coming because it did seem like it was like, okay, well, she's old news now. Ilsa Faust has been in this a little bit while. Let's give Tom Cruise a new girl, your new love interest. And that was Hayley Atwell. And that kind of cheapens both of the characters for both Hayley Atwell and Ilsa Faust. And for that reason is why I ranked Dead Reckoning as low as I did, was because the deaths didn't, while they had impact on the characters, it was predictable. And for me, it did feel like they were just simply going, well, out with the old, Rebecca Ferguson, in with the new, Hayley Atwell. I did, however, like Hayley Atwell's character.
Yeah.
And I enjoyed the fight sequence, and it was a fitting send-off for Ilsa Faust. She held her own against Gabriel, but he just slightly edged her out. But it was predictable. A lot of this movie for me seemed predictable, whereas a lot of the other entries in the Mission Impossible franchise, you don't see the twists occurring. So it didn't quite work for me with how they ousted or how they killed off Rebecca Ferguson's character. And sure, does this give Tom Cruise motivation to go after Gabriel? Absolutely. There was a little bit of a redemption for me when Luther then has a one-on-one conversation with Ethan where he is like, you can't kill Gabriel.
Yeah.
That was He's good. Like, you can't. He's like, because the AI is expecting you to do this and you have to be unexpectable at this point in time. You can't do what it is quantifying that you're going to do. So no matter what, you can't kill Gabriel. And there's the moment where he has the opportunity, but he doesn't. Mm-hmm. And in the end, he ends up stealing the key, which is the kind of the key to the whole sequence, which is going to get him access to the submarine that's now buried under 100 feet of ice in the middle of the Arctic. But I enjoyed both Rebecca Ferguson and Hayley Atwell. I did not enjoy the death of Ilsa Faust and the like replacement of Grace. That being said, Tom Cruise and Hayley Atwell did have some like very like tender moments together, especially towards the end of the movie when he actually does show up on the train to rescue her.
Yeah.
The exchange between the two of them was very heartfelt. You can sense that there will be like a good relationship between the two of them in this next movie. It did just feel like, well, we're going to pass on the old and we're going to bring in the young. Like that almost is how that like whole sequence felt to me. But let's talk action sequences. So you have a few of these sequences, right? The train scene being kind of one of the major sequences. But before that, and I will say this, and I know I've been talking for a couple of minutes and I'll pass the buck here in a moment, but I will say this. We all knew Tom Cruise was jumping the motorcycle off of the cliff and into a parachute. We saw this in the previews. The lead up to the jump took like 30 minutes. We knew it was coming. Why did it need to take 30 minutes for him to jump? Why did Simon Pegg have 20 minutes of going like, just keep driving, just keep driving, just keep driving, just keep driving? Like, it took so long to get to the final jump. But then the train sequence blew my mind.
It's funny, when I was watching, before I saw the movie, if you remember in Rogue Nation, the big stunt, one of the biggest stunts was him on the side of the plane.
Right.
And I remember sitting down for Rogue Nation, and that happened in the first 5 minutes of the movie.
Right.
And I said to my girlfriend before we saw this film, I was like, I kind of hope that jump is like in the first 15 minutes of the beginning. Because I wanted there to be, they promoted it so much. I saw so many behind the scenes videos of it. I was like, I'm still excited for it, but I hope they were holding something up their sleeve that we didn't know about or that was going to be really impressive. Because even with Fallout, he did the Halo jump, but he also flew the helicopter. He had to climb on a helicopter. There was stuff that I didn't know about until I saw the movie. And unfortunately, when we got towards the third act of the film, I was like you said, they're leading up to the jump. I'm like, okay, well, I've seen this jump 10 times. Mm-hmm. I was kind of hoping this would be somewhere earlier in the film. And then when that jump happened, it happened pretty quick. Like, once he finally did do it, I was like, oh, yeah, that was really cool, impressive. But thankfully, they did end it with that whole train sequence with the bridge. And that was something that was hinted at in the trailers, but not to the extent that we saw in the movie. So I still kind of wish that jump was, like, somehow in the beginning of the movie. And then we were able to discover some more stuff throughout the film. This film, it felt like they didn't hold their cards as much. They put way more of the sequences in the trailer. But I don't know. I'm trying to think Fallout. Fallout definitely showed a lot too, but I don't know. It just felt different for some reason. This one felt like a lot of it was in the trailer, and the biggest sequences were in the trailers. And they didn't hold back as much. I kind of wish they did, but saying that, I'm still super impressed with the whole third act. I'm super impressed with the chase scene. I love the opening airport scene, like the fight scene in the hallway, like every set piece delivered, even though they kind of showed their hand before they in the trailer.
I think it fits in with the Mission Impossible's whole motif. Like, I think in general, the action sequences in the franchise, they go on for a little longer than I would like. So I don't think it's anything different than they've done in all of their films thus far. Like, and I'm terrified of heights, so him driving up the mountain and things like that was more like anxiety inducing than the jump and the sequences on the train. So that did not feel out of place to me, because to me, I was like on the edge of my seat, like just because they were on a mountain, and it made me feel queasy like I was on a mountain. But just in general, I think an action sequence, once it gets above like 3 or 4 minutes and it's the same thing, it tends to get redundant. And a lot of the action scenes in Mission Impossible tend to last like 10 or 15 minutes.
I definitely think the train sequence was my favorite action, like, set piece in the movie. That was a lot of fun. I know a lot of people are considering it to, like, the what is it? It's not Fallout. What is the name of the game with
Uncharted.
Thank you. And I have seen, like, where people have pasted like that scene versus like the Uncharted scenes, and okay, it's fine. It's inspired by that. But at the same time, like it just blows my mind, like how awesome it was. And I understand like there is green screens and CG involved in this, but it looked crisp. It looked like it was actually happening. Like they were jumping from cart to cart to cart as the train was falling. So that whole sequence right there, I thought was one of the best parts of the movie. But like I said, I feel like some of it just drew out a little bit. Like, you knew what was going to be coming, so just get to it rather than spend 2 hours and 43 minutes or 30 minutes leading up to this. Just give a nice little lead up and get to the point. One thing that was interesting to me, and I'm curious your guys' takes. I don't know if I'm 100% on board with it or if I just think it was stupid. But the little tiny yellow Fiat running through Rome, did that sequence work for you guys? Did it not? Benny, what's your thoughts on that? You seem to like a little more humor in your action. Did the little yellow Fiat rather than the cool racing car work for you?
I appreciated it. And I appreciated the nonsense with the handcuffs, like getting in the wrong side of the car. Like, I don't know if you, the chase scenes in The Rock where there's a bunch of just stupidity going on. Those are the kind of car chases that to me work, because I don't find car chases just people driving a car into other things. Like, you know, I live in the Midwest. I can go to a demolition derby in the summer and see that for real if I want to. So it doesn't really do much for me in movies if that's the case. So the fact that there's something to laugh at or something else to focus on makes the chase sequences far more interesting to me. So I appreciated it. More so just the logistics of trying to drive with someone handcuffed to you in a really awkward way, I thought was more interesting than the Fiat. But overall, I enjoyed that compared to most car chase scenes.
How about you, JT? How did that Rome sequence work for
you? Yeah, I enjoyed it because it was a different tone than some of the other action set pieces in the movie. And I appreciate an action movie that gives you something a little bit more lighthearted, silly, but then something a little more serious, like the whole party into the fight, into the hallway fight. Like, that was dead serious. There was no thing that was like someone's going to die. And that scene was playful. It was fun. And I like when scenes go on and you're like, okay, it's time to end. And then they kind of keep going and you're like, okay, you got me back. I was like, it's going another level. I'm kind of into it now. And having Palm chase them down, who looked like just an absolute maniac, and she looked like she was having the time of her life. So yeah, there's a lot of aspects of that sequence I really enjoyed. I really have no complaints about any of the action in this movie. I think every action set piece delivers is interesting, suspenseful, you know, and impressive. Like my problems with the movie is more just some of the story beats and some of the motivations and the dense and how dense it is at times. And a lot of dialogue is just exposition. And I don't mind that, but I did feel like it was a little overkill at times. So to me, the action sequences, the filmmaking, top notch. It's the story I feel like maybe could have been tightened. And I agree with you, Haas, like it's too long. I think if you cut down some of those dialogue scenes, you cut down some of that exposition and figure out a better way to do it, this could have been 2 hours and 20 minutes and would have been a much tighter and it would have better pacing overall.
Well, folks, we're going to be reaching our final thoughts here, and let's give your what you guys loved about the movie, what you didn't love about the movie, what you're hoping for in the next movie. And Benny, I'll kick off with you, buddy.
I would say the biggest drawback in this entire movie for me is that Vin Rames has completely checked out as an actor. like it points, you know, when JTE was talking about the dialogue scenes, I expected him to look at the camera and wink, like, so we would know that he was doing this ironically. Like, I was kind of hoping he would do it. Like, that's how bad the dialogue scenes with him were in this movie. That's the biggest negative in the whole thing for me. I would say the biggest positive for me is, as someone that is not huge on these epic spy thrillers, is it just seemed like there was more fun in this one to be had than generally there are in the Mission Possible movies. So going to a spy movie is always, you know, not something that I'm geared up to do, but I left this one being like, yeah, that was fun. I enjoyed that. And if I was going to watch a Mission Possible movie like for a second time in the next year or two, it would probably be this one. So I would encourage you to go out there if you're a fan of just popcorn summer action movie. And I think even if you are someone that's really into the Mission Possible franchise, it's not going to let you down or take you away from the franchise in any way.
JT?
Yeah, I love this franchise. I think it's the fact that it's kind of become like some of the best made films, just period. I think the production, every aspect of production is top notch. And as someone who loves cinema and, you know, saw Fast X a couple months ago, so much care goes into every shot, every line, every composition. I appreciate that. As a film lover and someone who loves the craft, I appreciate what Tom Cruise and McQuarrie are doing with this franchise. And it's just refreshing. It's honestly refreshing. It doesn't feel like you're just putting out a product. They really do feel like they're trying to make something that will stand the test of time. That's not CG overload. In 20 years, it'll be like, this looks horrible, like Fast X. If it sounds like I'm shitting on Fast X a lot, it's because while I was on vacation, I watched it again. And I think I feel more negative about it after watching it a second time. I rewatched Fast X maybe a day or two after watching Dead Reckoning. So I just appreciate the movie so much. I'm really excited for part two. I can't wait to see, because we have nothing to go on in part two, like what the stunt's going to be. I have no idea what the plot's going to be. You know, you have an idea where it's going to go from here, but I'm real curious to see them. I feel like they're holding the best for last. I feel like this was a really good setup for whatever part two is going to be. And part two is going to be balls to the wall awesome. I do wish in the beginning, when you saw Kittredge for the first time, he was talking with like all the head guys, right? I wish you had Anthony Hopkins in there. I wish you had Alec Baldwin in there. I wish Kittredge in there. Bring back all the main people from the previous films. And I heard somebody say this on our podcast. I'm just going to repeat it. Haley Atwell's a thief, right?
Yes.
She's basically just a thief. Bring back the girl from Mission Possible 2. That was her whole role in Mission Possible 2. From what's her name? I just blanked on her name too. Yes, Thandie Newton. She literally is almost playing the same role Haley Atwell played. I would have liked to have brought her back. And then you already have that history, and it brings up the stakes a little bit. And she's basically doing the same thing that she was doing in the second film. So I kind of wish there was a little bit more of the pulling back characters and actors from the previous films. Where's Jeremy Renner? He didn't die. Is he going to show up in part two? I hope part two brings everybody back. If you're alive in the previous Mission Impossible movie, Paula Patton, I say bring her back. Jonathan Rhys Meyers, bring him back. Bring everybody back for one epic last mission. But I think Tom Cruise also said these might not be the last two films. He mentioned in an interview that he would love to be doing Mission Impossible movies until he's like 80, kind of like Harrison Ford. So maybe these won't be the last two films. And last thing I'll touch on is in Fallout, I kind of started seeing the age a little bit with Tom Cruise. And I felt like it was much more prevalent in this film. He did look like he aged quite a bit from Fallout to this film. And I'm curious how he's going to look in the next one, because it's starting to look, I mean, listen, Liam Neeson did take it, so they could pull it off. Cruise is, you know, almost unhuman, but I can't lie. While I was watching the movie, I was like, oh yeah, Tom Cruise is getting old. Like it's starting to really show. Scientology can only do so much to stop your aging. You're eventually going to start showing it. But overall, that's all hearsay. I love the movie for the most part. And I'm really excited to see part two and watch. I can't wait to watch part one the night before I go see part two and go right into that theater and be like, let's go. Cause I feel like I'm going to be so pumped up. So yeah. Long live Tom Cruise. Long live Mission Impossible.
Bring back Emilio.
Yes. Bring him back.
Yeah. Give him the eye patch. I mean, we could just play that off as he got stabbed in the eye and somehow survived. There you go. I'm very excited for part two of this. I did very much enjoy this movie. The movie dragged for me at times, and that's only because it's 2 hours and 43 minutes. I think some of the action sequences were just a little too long. So there were pacing issues for me in this movie. However, I did very much enjoy it. I did not enjoy, I mentioned it in length earlier, the pass off between Ilsa Faust and Hayley Atwell's Grace. I love the villain. I think the AI and the AI choosing human forms or human people to be able to like do its bidding is fascinating. And I hope that that is explored a little more with you, Benny. The look of the AI, like, it, come on, it's an AI. It can change the way it looks. It doesn't have to be your 90s, you know, screensaver. But overall, I very much enjoyed the movie. If you are a fan of the Mission Impossible movies, you will enjoy this movie too. I do hope that the second movie elevates the first movie a little bit more because there are a lot of like unfinished storylines. There's a lot of things that are mentioned in the first one that need to be explained more in the second one. But overall, I did very much enjoy this movie. I think we are eventually going to witness Tom Cruise, the junkie that is the adrenaline junkie that is Tom Cruise. We are going to see him age out of the ability to be able to play Ethan Hunt. I thought when they introduced Jeremy Renner, I thought that Renner was actually at some point in time going to take over kind of the Tom Cruise, Ethan Hunt type role. But I'm with JT. There are a lot of characters that they've introduced in the IMF that have been kind of one and done or two and done. I would like to see Renner back again. Absolutely. Bring back Jonathan Rhys Meyers. Bring back Paula Patton. Bring back Thandi Newton. Like, let's have the Avengers assemble of the Mission yes. Impossible universe versus the AI, you know, in this next one. It would be awesome. But also, there are so many, like, other operatives and facets of, like, the IMF that, like, I do hope that they explore a little bit more. Because they alluded to it with that scene that you're talking about, JTE, with all the government officials yeah. and all the government heads that – the IMF, they just mention things to them. They're just stuff that we can't handle that we just put out in the ether and the IMF picks it up. What if somebody chooses not to accept? I fully anticipate, I said this the other day on Amaru's show, One's Gotta Stay. I fully anticipate that the way that this movie ends is Tom Cruise is going to get a mission that he chooses not to accept. That is going to be how Ethan Hunt exits the IMF. But I'm hoping that there's more to the IMF that shows up in this next movie, because it can't just be Ethan Hunt and his team. They can't be the only ones in IMF fighting this impossible villain that is artificial intelligence. So my hope for the next one is that there is like more IMF agents that are invested in this, that you just get the whole like brunt of the, you know, impossible mission force against this impossible mission that is AI. There's so many possibilities that can happen in the next one, but I am excited. I did very much enjoy this movie. It's not my favorite of the Mission Impossibles, but you mentioned something, JT, like rewatching this before going and seeing the next one. There's a possibility, and I said this when we were just kind of shooting the shit in between takes, that my enjoyment of the Mission Impossible movies can vary on watching. I could rewatch the whole series and be like, you know what? Ghost Protocol is the best one. Mm-hmm. And today I ranked it at number 4. So this, my feelings very well might change with the release of the next one, with a rewatching of this one. But folks, you will absolutely enjoy Tom Cruise. And the running sequence, this was the best running sequence. When he's running through that hallway of just lighted candles, it was like, okay, you know what you're doing with Tom Cruise running. Best running sequence of the Mission Impossible movies in this one.
I don't know. That part 3 where he's in China and he's running nonstop for like half a mile. That's and the Dubai from the Sandstorm. That's a tough call, man. I'd have to go back, rewatch all the running scenes before I could crown a champion. And before we go, I want to just stick up a little bit for my man, Ving Rhames. I like him in these movies. I like in Ghost Protocol when he shows up at the very end. And I thought his dialogue, anytime he's talking to Ethan Hunt, I feel that friendship through all these films, unlike when he talks to some of these other people, because he's just been there from the get-go, man. He's the only guy who's been there through every single movie. So I enjoy their interaction, and I enjoy Ving Rhames. Sorry, Benny. I understand. His delivery is not the best, maybe, but he's just there, man. I'm here.
I mean, in the long history of Ving Rhames movies, will we ever consider Ving Rhames to be the greatest actor in those movies?
No.
He's great at Pulp Fiction. At least he was at some point acting. He's not acting anymore. He's just talking.
Fair enough. Well, folks, coming up on our next episode, we're going to have the Barbenheimer dilemma. So we're going to actually be putting out 2 episodes, because these are arguably probably going to be the 2 most anticipated movies for almost everyone this year. It might be the 2 largest movies of the year. They're certainly the most talked about. So Barbenheimer week will happen. We will have an episode for Oppenheimer, and we will have an episode for the Barbie movie. So please like, click, subscribe, continue tuning into our podcast. We love doing it for you folks. And as always, I want to thank the fine gentlemen on the panel with me, JT, Benny Hamlin. I am Moosos. Have a good night, everybody.
Good night, everybody.
IMF agents, assemble.